Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers. My guest today is songwriter Bobby Hart, who has written and co-written some of the most enduring popular hits of the 20th century. Most famous for working with Tommy Boyce as the duo Boyce and Hart, they not only charted hits like I Wonder What She's Doing Tonight and Out and About, but wrote and produced The Monkees' first album and their biggest hit, Last Train to Clarksville. Bobby's autobiography, Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles, is the story of how Bobby found his way not only to professional and financial success, but to personal satisfaction and spiritual enlightenment, all while center stage during the most exciting time in rock and roll history. Finding himself, Bobby healed his injuries and scars, and in his book, he's happy to share with enthusiasm, wisdom, charm, and humor lessons on how anyone can create the life they want. And he tells some great stories along the way, and he does so with me today. Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles is available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, from the official Boyce and Hart website, BoyceandHart.com, and of course, your locally owned and operated book retailer. If you find Bobby as charming and insightful as I did during this interview, you're going to want this book. Here's my interview with songwriter Bobby Hart.
It's Deep Dish Podcast. Subscribe today and tell a friend about Deep Dish Podcast with Tim Powers. With Tim Powers.
So let's start out. You started as a rockabilly singer.
Yeah, actually, I didn't know it, but I guess that's what I was. I'd come to L.A. 18 years old, just dropped off on the corner of Hollywood and Vine, and as green as you can get. I came to go to disc jockey school, and I got sidetracked right away by a little sign I passed on the way to work every morning that said, "Come in to see what your voice sounds like. $10." That was a little recording studio. And so I finally did that and started making demos, and immediately, I'd say within 2 or 3 months, I was abandoning my disc jockey dreams and having dreams of becoming a rock and roll star.
Well, yeah, even as a fledgling rock and roll star, you'd have made more money at that than you ever would as a disc jockey, I'll tell you.
That's true.
But you had your finger on the pulse of the industry from a weird 50-foot view even before that, running a press, right?
Yeah, I had to, you know, I came here with $50 in my pocket, so I had to get a job, and I did have some skills running an automated Heidelberg press. So I set out on a Monday morning, my first week in town, armed with all of the print shops whose telephone number started with HO for Hollywood. I knew that was the Hollywood area prefix.
Yep.
So So by noon, I had a job running Heidelberg Press's printing record labels.
And so you were printing the labels of the singles that kids would be picking up down the street at the record store, not that far away. So you told this story about how you had an idea of what was going to come up the charts by the volume of printing that you were doing. Can you talk about that?
Well, I started hanging out this little recording studio, making demos. Every Saturday, every moment I had off, I'd be in there and spending all the money I had. And a guy recognized something in me early on and said, you know, you guys, I like what I'm hearing that you're making, these demos you're making, and why don't you go down and see this friend of mine named Jesse Hodges, he's a record producer, he might like what you're doing. So I went down and saw Jesse, played him a couple demos, and at that point I hadn't written anything. They were just songs like You Are My Sunshine and kind of generic things that I was updating. And Jesse said, you know, you sound good, but I'm really only interested in singers that have their own material. That's what I'm looking for. Go home and write some songs and then come back and see me. So just because he told me to, I did. I had no idea how, but I had a guitar and had some musical training as a kid. So I came back to him with songs, and he signed me to a recording contract to his record production company, probably not more than 4 months after hitting town. So that's what I was doing Tim, forgive me. What was the question I was trying to answer?
I'm just letting it roll, Bobby. the question that I asked was if you could tell the story about how you knew it was happening with the charts.
Yeah, so I had a recording contract with the production company within 4 months of hitting town. And so Jesse said, you know, hang out at the office now, you're part of the family. And I'd meet people there like Dorsey and Johnny Burnett, pioneers of rock and roll. And,
right.
And indirectly I met Tommy Boyce through Jesse. But anyway, Jesse had this scheme he told me about, or this idea, I should say, in deference, God rest his soul. He said, you know, both Cashbox and Billboard magazines, which had the charts of the hit songs of the day, they both had this policy where they would list a song that would be selling, and under the song would be all of the people who had recorded that song. Sometimes in those days, several people would record the same song.
Right.
And it didn't matter who had the hit, they would all be listed under the song. It was kind of a strange, bizarre system, but that's the way it was. So he saw a loophole there for his artist. He said, if I can figure out soon enough what song is going to be on the chart soon, I'll just cut that as a B-side for one of my acts, and I'll have instant publicity because their name will be under the song along with the hit version. So I said, I can help with that because I'm printing record labels. I can tell before the charts which ones are going to sell by the orders, how big the orders are for the records.
Wow. And
so I kind of got in trouble doing that. I gave him Richie Valens. his new single coming out was called Come On Let's Go, I think. And I said, wow, they're really ordering big on this, coming off of La Bamba. And so that was a great plan, and Jesse was going in the studio, and somebody leaked it back to the record company that Richie Valens was on, which was Bob Keane's label.
Right.
And he didn't take it well at all that this idea was going on. And I came in one morning, and the guy I worked for said, our biggest client just demanded that I fire you today. And he gave me a stern talk, and he didn't fire me, but I learned a little lesson there about insider trading.
So, and this is about 1956, 7, thereabouts?
I came here on New Year's Day, 1958, and so it would have still been 58.
Okay. And, you know, so you have this recording contract, and you had, you know, your manager's trying to get the Bobby Hirschman singles played around the country in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And none of them really, really took off.
No, I must have had a dozen singles between my first real success as an artist, and that first song that I released, I mean, I just kept plugging away,
right,
having another bomb.
Well, it made me wonder when I was reading, you know, you're cut from a similar cloth. You have radio in your blood. You know, you played, yeah, disc jockey. You wanted to go to disc jockey school, and I'm wondering if about this time, in popular music, well, first of all, local disc jockeys were programming their own music, which they don't do anymore. But
right,
they were, shall we say, encouraged to play certain singles. And
that's true. There was the whole payola era, which really peaked in the 50s when the federal government started investigating that,
right,
that all this was going on, the pay for play, and didn't think it was kosher. And some of the biggest ones, like Alan Freed, not only out of business but in jail. I think he did jail time, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right.
And of course, Dick Clark
dodged that bullet pretty quickly.
He dodged it, yeah. I'm sure he had something going on, but it wasn't. He was much smarter than some of the other ones.
Yeah. But and I'm wondering if that, if that was going on at a time that might have affected the Bobby Hirschman singles,
I suppose so. I was signed to a small record label called Radio Records, and
right,
it was not that they certainly weren't throwing money at these places. I remember our first promotion trip was just driving from Los Angeles to San Francisco and looking for radio towers along the way, and we'd just go in unannounced and ask, give them the record, and they'd play it, and we'd be off to the next one. But I'm sure it was not consistent play. I'm sure they didn't continue,
yeah,
playing it.
It's like once you were out the door, they're like, okay, back to Chuck Berry.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. It's really the first third of the book is the ascent and some of the things that you went through. And I noticed a common theme. I noticed three common themes throughout the whole book. The first is loneliness, which, I learn a lot about the man, Bobby Hart, in that. The second is your spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third is radio, which just spoke to me.
Yeah.
You know, this kid in the middle of nowhere in Arizona, and his connection to the world was whatever came in through AM radio.
That's true.
And that's a story that I hear from a lot of the disc jockeys that I looked up to, and a lot of the rock stars that I looked up to and related to it myself.
Yeah.
And so, tell me a little bit about what it was like to be little Bobby Hirschman with your AM console, and what you picked up and what you heard and how it influenced you.
Well, it's very insightful, Tim. I like that. My first radio set was a cat whisker crystal set, and I don't suppose anybody knows what those are.
Did you build it yourself?
No, my dad built it for me.
Cool.
We were from, I would call it a really poor family until later when my dad started doing better, but I never lacked for what I needed and the things that I was interested in. He always supported. He was the kind of guy that was big into hobbies and himself, and he would find cheap ways to make things. And so he just read it. I remember he used to bring home these Popular Science and Popular Mechanics magazines, and they'd show you how to do things in there. So he found an actual quartz crystal in the desert, and he found how to make a little cat whisker. And what it was just a small piece of wire attached to a handle, and you would adjust that handle so the end of the wire was touching one of these different spots that had crystal on them.
And that was your tuning.
That's how you would tune from one station to another.
Yeah.
And you had to use earphones to hear it.
I built one in junior high.
You did? Oh.
Yeah.
So then later I got a real radio, of course, but you're right. It was radio that was my pipeline to the world. And I remember a trip to Ohio to visit with my mom, to visit her father. My grandfather lived on a farm with no indoor plumbing and quite primitive. But he had a big barn, which I immediately took over to make my little play radio station out of. because it was quiet out there and I could do whatever I wanted. And he had an old cylinder record player, and people don't remember those either, but it was vinyl before vinyl was flat.
Right.
There were cylinders that spun around and the needle would go, would be stationary.
No electricity, right? It's a Victrola?
No electricity. Would crank it up. And I was having a great time spinning the tunes on the old cylinder. But I cranked it too hard one time, and the crank came off, and I broke the thing. And so a friend loaned me their radio, and I tuned into a country station back there in Ohio somewhere that was playing I Got a Feeling Called the Blues. The old Hank Williams record was a great record. I recorded later on. And so that was kind of my introduction. I don't know, might have been 6, 7 to country music. And that was my, that's what I just gravitated to. And back in Phoenix, our number one station was a country station. Bunch of hillbillies.
We were, I was going to say, what else were they listening to, you know?
Yeah.
What else?
And so when that was, you know, I preferred that over what they called popular music. Before pop, it was popular, and that was the Sinatra-style crooners, and I could not relate to that very much. It just didn't touch me. I didn't feel like it had any soul to it.
Because it didn't.
Well, I suppose, you know, I later became a big fan of Frank Sinatra when I saw him sing in person.
Of course.
And he did have such charisma and good, you know, and such technique. And at times I would even say he had a little soul, but some of them didn't. Some of them just were just technique only.
Right.
So I listened to country that whole time, and then till rockabilly came in. And when the rockabilly came in, our country station KHEP in Phoenix was the first to play Elvis and Gene Vincent and Carl Perkins. And
was it Elvis that did it for you, or was it the other class of 57? You know,
it was all of those guys. I remember those were three big influences. Gene Vincent, I just loved Bebopalula.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Elvis. I got to see Elvis at the Arizona State Fairgrounds when I was probably in 12th grade or maybe earlier than that. When he just had it, I think it was his first single on RCA. I think it was Hound Dog. And
wow.
And Don't Be Cruel or something, or maybe it was Heartbreak. I don't know. Maybe it was the second record. But anyway, that was an experience. And I loved Elvis as much as any of the girls in my class. I mean, it was just across the board. It was a new sound. And we didn't know that he was a country boy that was channeling all of the Southern gospel and black music that he had heard in Memphis. We didn't know what the influences were. We just knew this was something new to us. And it was... Talk about soul. I mean, this was heart-wrenching.
You just knew it was what it was.
Yeah.
Wow. You ever
every generation has that, I think. Every kid wakes up and says, wow, what was that? And it's something that his parents don't understand at all.
Yep.
But it speaks to him or her.
That's really true. You ever thought about going back to radio, and now with everybody having access to their own equipment now, you know, you ever thought about spinning discs and, you know, Bobby Hart spins,
you know,
the oldies?
I think I fulfilled my karmic desire in a couple of ways. One was before I came to Hollywood, I had done the reserve plan, Army Reserve plan, 6 months of active duty, and then summer camp and weekly meetings for 7 years. And so that 6 months was basic training at Fort Ord for 2 months, and then the other 4 months was at the Presidio in San Francisco, where I was in the Armed Forces Radio Service. So I got to start there. That was my first time of actually being a DJ,
right.
Emceeing the Sixth Army Band programs that we would send out. So I got to start it there, and then it kind of culminated maybe in 68 or 69 when Tommy and I were asked, Tommy Boyce, after our hits, we got a call from Wixie in Cleveland, Ohio, and the program director said, our evening guy is leaving, and I think he's leaving on a Friday, and our new guy to take his place isn't coming until Monday, how would Boyce and Hart like to come in and be our DJ for the weekend? So we jumped at it, and that was a real thrill, and that was the top station in a big record market. So that really really fed my desire, and I think I got it out of my system.
Fair enough. Of the three things that I noticed, the second one was your spiritual journey. And I thought it was interesting how this Pentecostal kid from middle Arizona went to discover, Eastern philosophy. And I got to ask, who saw the Maharishi first, you or the Beatles?
I never do that timeline. I can probably say that when I met him would have been 1965.
Then you were first.
Probably so, because there was a small. What happened? I was just kind of talking in general about some of the books I was reading on mysticism to mm-hmm. Henry Louis, our engineer at Western Recorders, and Henry said, "Well, you know, I'm into that too. I meditate." And a few weeks later, he invited me to go with he and his wife to this small little private home in Los Angeles to see the Maharishi Mahesh Yoga speak. And this room, it was not a big house. It was a small house, and the living room probably didn't hold more than 25 people. So it was definitely early on, and that was, I'm sure everything changed once the Beatles visited him.
Right.
Rishikesh. But he was just so jolly and so full of joy. So blissful, and he didn't matter what the question was. The answer was always the same: just do this transcendental meditation, and your life will get better.
And it turned things around for you, which was really
interesting. That was the beginning. Actually, not the beginning, but it was a big step. My first meditation techniques came from that organization, and I did that for maybe 7 or 8 years before. I found my guru and his teachings and actually read his book in 1968, but didn't actually sign up for initiation into the meditation techniques till 10 years later. But that was the start. That and some of the books I had read.
And you're still practicing today?
Still practicing and active in the church and still play the Hammond B3 organ, which is my... what I played in clubs in the early 60s. Yeah, my axe.
Yeah, it was that your spirituality, I think, that as I got into the final third of the book, it seemed like you found your footing as an individual after being part of a partnership. Whether it was with Boyce or with any of the other guys that you worked with before then, or even your romantic relationships.
And it's true.
Go ahead.
I always seemed to have a partner. I was, as I talked about early in the book, I was painfully shy as a kid, and one of the things that attracted me to radio, I wanted to be somebody and stand out, but even the thought of appearing in front of a crowd would be terrifying. So I thought, radio, I'll be in this little dark studio. Nobody will see me, but right. I can still be a star. So I always hooked up with somebody who was much more outgoing than I was. And Tommy Boyce was the epitome of that. And the great run that we had for 10 years, he was the front man and helped me to come out of my shell. By high school, I was pretty much out of the shell. But
then there's Tommy.
There's Tommy, which is just, over the top. And after Tommy and I weren't working together, it was Danny Jansen in the 70s, and it was Dick Eastman in the 80s. I wrote this book by myself first, was not happy with it. I liked parts of it, but I knew it wasn't ready. And until I hooked up with Glenn Ballantyne, who really helped bring out a lot of the stuff that I hadn't even thought of. I was writing too much like a songwriter, doing the stories very quickly, as I had done in interviews for years, you know,
yeah,
get on to the next one. But he helped me to bring out the details and to describe what it looked like, what I was going through, and what the smells in the air were, and so on. So
right.
The partnership has just worked well for me my whole life. And as you said, meeting my wife, Mary Ann, in 1980 was at just about the same time as I got Kriya Yoga, which is the meditation technique that I do. And that was a big turning point for me. I think the awakening, you know, I was quite spiritual as a kid in the Christian church.
Right.
That had a couple big advantages for me. One was beginning of a relationship with God by seeing those around me that were serious about their spiritual lives. But the second one was the music, because of this kind of church that I grew up with. It was a great breeding ground for the kind of, you know, for being a kind of a foundation for what I would build on in my music career. But the spiritual thing then kind of, as I reached puberty and through my early years of having stardom and success, the opportunities were very tempting, and so I took advantage of that and kind of put on the shelf some of my spiritual principles until the 60s, and there was this cultural revolution that Tommy and I were immersed in. We came back to California after having some success in New York. We signed to come back here with we came back here to sign with Screen Gems Columbia Music, a publishing company.
Right.
And it's just that the timing was right. The scene was building. The Summer of Love was coming. The kids were gathering on the Sunset Strip, and the love-ins and the be-ins. And so partially having to do with psychedelic drugs being discovered and being become, I guess it came from Timothy Leary and those Harvard professors, who Richard Alpert, who were experimenting with LSD and psychedelics. But
right.
Somehow that had a connection to some. Most it didn't. Most it was not a spiritual journey to take LSD. It was a journey to go out and trip and say, oh, wow, look at the colors. You know?
Right.
But to some, there was that awakening that brought curiosity about deeper kinds of spiritual experience that we weren't hearing about in our local little churches. So I began to get recommended from some of these people who were taking these drugs to read certain books, and they started to open my head up again just as early as 63, 64. And luckily I didn't get deep into the morass of having to take the chemicals myself, because I could see what was going. We were immersed in all of this, but
right.
we were somewhat observers. We were there to be at the love-ins, but we were also professionals by that point. We had offices, and we were writing hit songs and cutting records.
So you got to straddle both worlds, really.
Yeah, we were straddling both, and we could kind of look as observers and see, well, there's a lot of these kids that are, the stuff was prevalent, because it was, even in the early days, even before it was illegal, it was just there in all shapes and forms and colors. But we could see the toll it was taking on a number of these people, and we could see that it wasn't just all peace and love. So we kind of tried to steer past that and take the good things. And what I heard Indian music, East Indian music, for the first time, and I was, wow, what is that? That was like, this is different. This is semitonal, you know.
Yeah.
This is instruments I've never heard. And then that led me to curiosity to read some of the books and eventually find Paramahansa Yogananda as my spiritual teacher.
And here you are. And wow. You were right. I mean, you had your finger on the pulse of everything that was happening and that time. And I mean, I read a lot of rock star autobiographies or pop star autobiographies, and you know, some are better than others. And you are very clear about the fact that for lack of a better term, you kind of stayed sober that whole time, that you weren't much of a drinker. You really stayed away from drugs. And in that time and in that industry, as you are, you yourself are in the eye of the hurricane, was it a challenge to stay out of that?
Yeah, well, yes, it was. You know, the thing is about what you were saying, being in the eye of the hurricane, I think that what helped both of us is watching people around us. I mean, a lot of our contemporaries didn't make it through.
Yeah.
And it was pretty obvious to see what the downside risks were to some of this. And, you know, some of it, I suppose, some people might have said, well, this helps my creativity or whatever. But there might have been pluses, but we could also see the toll it was taking on our friends, some of our friends, and you know, we lost a bunch of them, and that was sad.
Well, then let's shift gears a little bit, and while you were in the eye of the hurricane, there are a couple of experiences that you relayed in the book that are fascinating to me, who was not there. And I think one of the things that really exploded your head was Monterey.
Monterey was a whole different experience. Monterey Pop Festival, the one and only, the first international Monterey Pop Festival, where they used to hold jazz festivals in Central California. A beautiful weekend and being exposed to some kinds of music I had never heard before. It started when Tommy and I came back to California. You know, the first half of the 60s was a whole different musical genre than the second half.
Right.
If you look at it, and the first half was still the Paul Ankers and the and some of the doo-wop girl
groups. Your Bobby Rydells and your...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Frankie Avalon. But...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The second half, and we left, I got here early in 1965, so we were here where in the epicenter, first half was all coming from New York, basically. The music business was New York driven. That all started to shift in 1965. It wasn't because I came back, but it just happened to work out.
I understand there were four other guys who had a pretty significant influence on everything. You were part of it, Bobby. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. But, you know, even Motown moved out here, and the Eastern, the situated companies all started West Coast offices. And so when we got here, we were still writing. We were getting our songs recorded by Herman's Hermits and Gary Lewis and the Playboys and Dino Desi and Billy, kind of the softer rock guys. But we immediately started checking out the clubs in L.A. in 65 and on.
And you were watching people freak out.
People were freaking, but the music was changing.
Yeah.
You know, we were seeing The Doors, and we were seeing Arthur Lee's Love, and there was all this new music we were hearing, and that started to infiltrate into our record productions. And so now we're getting cuts by Paul River and the Raiders, and Eric Burdon and the Animals, and so a little harder edge to the songs that we were starting to write and produce, and so music was changing, and that was something that Tommy and I were pretty adept at. We read the charts every week religiously and made sure that we were familiar with every cut on the top 100 and analyzed what we thought made it a hit.
But
and, uh, Yeah.
You guys were on the strip watching the Doors and watching the Mothers and the birds and all that happen. But something just, according to the book, something just switched at Monterey, and it may have been Hendrix, but it may have been the whole scene. But I noticed a shift in your perception from that point. Am I off on that?
Not at all. I think you're right about that. It was a shift. There was stuff there that we had not seen even at the Whiskey. And one of the things was Ravi Shankar, who played an entire afternoon.
Yeah.
Of just, that was, we didn't know music like this existed, that you could take a theme and make and just go off on it for hours, you know. It was amazing. And then, of course, Janis was great, but that was not new to me. I've been playing in clubs for years, doing white R&B, and that's what she was doing, because she did it great.
Yeah.
But Hendrix, that was new, and I didn't really understand it at all, but it had a tremendous impact, as it did on everybody who saw him at Monterey. That was one of his first big showcases where a lot of industry people saw him. And that's where Janis got signed from as well. But Hendrix, we just didn't know what was going on up there, setting his guitar on fire and playing it behind his back with his, you know, with all that feedback, and it's just him and a drummer and a bass player, and it sounds like it's a wall of sound. And so we were blown away by it. Mickey Dolenz was there, and he said, let's sign this guy to open our concerts. Everybody was, we were impressed. We just didn't know what it was at the beginning.
Oh, that's right. You were on that tour too, weren't you? You were backing up the guys on the Monkees Hendrix tour.
Hendrix replaced me. When we first went out, they had asked me and my band, the Candy Store Prophets, to come along on the Monkees tours. On their first Monkees tours, and for about a year, and we would open the show before they came out, and then we would back each of the four Monkees as they did a solo song in the set, and that was an explosive time.
12,000 little pink arms reaching out at you.
Boy, it was crazy. I talk about in the book. I talk about. Book is called Psychedelic Bubblegum, by the way.
Well, I'm going to do a pre-recorded intro before the whole thing, so okay. I'm going to set everything up.
Yeah, I was just going to explain why we called it Psychedelic Bubblegum. It's not about drugs. It's about the music. And I was reflecting that we got Tommy and I got pigeonholed as writing bubblegum music for these, pre-pubescent kids. And so they called it bubblegum music. But then when we started having these other influences that I was talking about with the feedback, Hendrix guitars and the Indian instruments, I said, there's a new genre that was evolving called psychedelic music. So I said, well, I probably should have called it psychedelic bubblegum. That's where that title came from.
That's fantastic. You know,
there was a question there. Get back to your question. It was a good one, and I didn't answer it. If you remember what it was.
Well, I mean, we were just rapping about what it was like on the. Let's get back to how your perception changed at Monterey. But I think we covered it with when Hendrix just kind of opened up the whole psychedelic thing. I mean,
we were talking about opening for the Monkees that we did it before him.
Yeah.
Then what was after that? I don't know.
We just kind of went on about. Tell me about your experience with Hendrix. I mean, you were on the plane, right? With the Monkees and Hendrix.
No. After we stopped touring with the Monkees, they hired Hendrix. That was about the same time. That was, I think, Monterey was 67, and that's when that was the beginning of the Voice and Heart career as artists, and so. We were into our own careers at that point.
And here we go.
here we go. And Hendrix took our place on the road.
Wow.
Opening act for the Monkees.
So
I did run into him on that trip. We had A&M Records signed Voice and Heart as recording artists, and they sent us on a 12-city a promotion tour for our first record. And we touched bases with the Monkees twice on that tour. One was in Miami, where we went backstage at the Monkees concert, and Mickey called Tommy and I out, and as he was singing "I Want to Be Free." And then when we got to New York, it was hearing about or watching these crowds, giant crowds standing on the sidewalk below the giant skyscraper where the Monkees were staying, and in the rain, and watching, you know, singing their song, our songs that we had written for them, and so on. And at one point, we did I did speak briefly with Hendrix, who at that point was thinking of leaving the tour, because you could imagine the Monkees audience,
right?
The Bubblegummers. If we didn't know what it was when we first saw it,
your 12-year-old from Akron, Ohio, doesn't know either.
Yeah. So the audience was not accepting him well on stage, and he was getting kind of depressed by that, about ready to leave. I think it was probably the week that he did decide to leave is when we saw him back there in that New York gig.
A week later, Purple Haze is on the charts.
Yes. It was just the beginning of his career. It was a big turning point for him.
Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. And so it was at that point, you know, Boyz II Men are touring, they're filling arenas and things like that. And, you know, we could... There's great stories about the music, but I think the most newsworthy thing that, and I say this with all due respect to the music, but one of the most important things that Boyz II Men did is you changed the Constitution of the United States. Will you tell me that story, Bobby?
Not single-handedly, but we had a part in it, and I'll always be proud of that. We signed with a new manager who did some fantastic things for us. So Joey... Joey Bishop had a talk show, an evening talk show. It was number two rated, next to just behind the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And Joey had us on his show quite often. He really liked us. And one time he called us and said, there are these kids up north at a university who started a campaign to lower the voting age to 18. And I've been supporting him on my show. And I'm going to go up and do this Love Rally, L-U-V, Let Us Vote Rally, at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. And what would you guys think about writing a theme song for this campaign and coming up and singing it? They're sending a Learjet jet for us. So we said, sure. So we got off the phone and wrote Let Us Vote, L-U-V, and went up. And that's where we could see there was this giant auditorium filled with kids who were very enthusiastic about lowering the voting age. And we met the fellow who was part of starting that off. He was a political science director for the school. And as things worked out, later hired him to be our manager. And the guy did unbelievable things for Boyz II Men, which I won't get into, but he just made
it's in the book.
Deal for us.
It's in the book.
It's in the book. Yeah. And but one of the things was that he arranged... They asked us, the campaign of kids asked us, and he was the point man on that, to be the national spokesperson. So we were going around the country doing newspaper, radio interviews, talking about it on our concerts, this campaign to lower the voting age, and then we actually went to Washington.
Yeah, you went to Congress.
And lobbied the senators and congressmen. And it turns out that they were all for it. I saw it as maybe there are more voters for them, or I don't know, but everybody seemed to be behind it. And took a couple of years for all the states to ratify it, but it happened. And
there's a great story in the book about when Alan Cranston pulled you guys aside. And I'm not gonna spoil the story, because I want folks to read this book. It's of all the pop star autobiographies that I've read, it's full of great stories. So you're able to pick it up wherever books are sold, of course. And so you went to Washington, and I mean, the rest is really history. The 18-year-old's now as a a result of many hands, including yours, the voting age was lowered to 18, which at the time seemed fair. To put it in perspective, 18-year-olds were dying in the jungles of Vietnam as well, but couldn't represent themselves.
That was our main impetus, really, because there was this war going on that a lot of the younger generation did not understand or believe in, and yet the draft was on, so they were being sent there against their will, patriotic as they were, but they still couldn't have a voice in electing politicians that might have had a different view. So we just didn't, we saw an inequity there that we wanted to get involved in. I'm hearing all these rumbles today about people who are trying to talk about lowering the voting age to 16 now. So I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
That may be a little too far.
And I've heard people say it was a terrible thing that we did that 18-year-olds don't, you know, but I don't believe that. I believe 18-year-olds are smarter than their parents a lot of times and have new perspectives. And certainly at that juncture in 1969, they needed to have a voice.
No, man, I registered to vote on my 18th birthday, March 5th, 1987. Go. There I was.
There you go.
So we'll talk a little bit about music. Your music's been recorded by like everybody from Chubby Checker to Quentin Tarantino to the Sex Pistols, right?
That's true.
Are there covers of your songs that you know people play for you and you shrug and go, well, that's one way to do it. That's not the way I saw it, but good on you. Are there things that you just kind of cock your head a little bit and go, well, okay,
sure. You always have that, but you're always gratified that somebody thought enough of your song to want to record it, and didn't maybe their vision of it, like you said, wasn't my vision of it. But it's who's to say who's right? There's no right or wrong in music or any kind of art.
You know,
there's some people make music that others don't understand, and some people make music for the masses.
That's my quote. That's my poll for the whole thing, Bobby. That's awesome. I love that. Let's see, where did I... Going through my notes here a little bit.
Yeah.
Can we talk about Matthews a little bit? I'm interested in what you learned in that arc, because he, no question, did some great things for Boyce and Hart. Yeah. But the denouement of that story is really powerful, and it is really one of the best stories in the book. What did you learn from your experience, not necessarily from Matthews, but from that experience?
Well, it had a very sad, tragic ending, actually, because of all the wonderful things that he created for us, things that we never would have, heights we never would have attained without him. He had actually larger dreams and goals for Boyce and Hart than Boyce and Hart did. And that's why we hired him. We could see this guy was an individual unlike any other who had done tremendous things in the past. We also knew that there was a dark side and a flaw in his personality, but we thought that we would just keep a close eye on that. And it turned out that it was also the undoing of Boyce and Hart.
Yeah, because when it all came down, Tommy took it really hard, and it really like a switch flipped in him at that moment.
That's true, and it's one that's been hard to, I have not really been able to explain it to myself over all these years, and so it's hard to explain it in the book other than to just to tell the chronological facts as I remember them of how it happened. That was a big one to blow Tommy's mind in that way.
Because that was going to be kind of my follow-up question. Why do you think that blew Tommy's mind as much as it did?
Yeah, like I said, I don't know the answer to it. I've heard speculations. I've heard we talk about the fact that Tommy and Matthews got close, and almost he wasn't that much older than us, but it still was a father figure kind of thing, I think, to Tommy. And just blew his mind when he felt betrayed by this person. That's one explanation. Somebody else used the word nervous breakdown. I would never use that, because Tommy continued to seem normal to me throughout it, other than the fact that that part of his life went away.
Right. And so much good came out of that, that period. So much, you know, it seemed like your creative energy was really high. You were everywhere. You know, it was what that 18-year-old kid who was sitting in front of the IHOP at Sunset and Vine wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, so
we it's true. And we had tried, both Tommy and I had tried to be recording artists for years, had been recording artists for years without much success to show for it. And so out of the Monkees came the opportunity to be a team of singers, and out of that came a success and fulfillment that we'd been looking for.
And there you are. And that's how Quentin Tarantino came to cover Boyce and Hart. which is a great story, again, in the book. And as much as I'd love to have you tell it, it's in the book. So Boyce and Hart, you know, comes to an end for a while. And, you know, you survive through the 70s and you have this, you don't tell stories that there was a story missing that I wanted to hear. And I don't know if it's there or not. So I'm going to ask. You live next door to Harry Nilsson.
Yes.
And everybody I know who's had any connection with Harry has Harry stories.
Yeah, you know, I never became close with him, and even though we're next door neighbors, but I did know him. I knew him way before that when he was a bank teller at Bank of America on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
And my connection with Harry was John Mariscalco, who was the pioneer, a pioneer of rock and roll, who wrote Rip It Up and Ready Teddy and Send Me Some Lovin' and Long Tall Sally, I guess he wrote that. He was a friend of, it was back to the Jesse Hodges connection way back in the late 50s. I became friends with John, and John cut singles with me in those days. But John was a friend of Harry's, and so I met him, but it was always kind of peripheral. Last time I saw Harry was at a restaurant on Sunset Strip, not too long before he passed,
right.
And he sent a bottle of wine over to my wife, and I were having lunch, and so we went over and sat next to him, and I don't know who he was sitting next to. Might have been Chuck Black. It was a drummer, I believe, and we chatted with him for a while, but we never had a close connection. I just know that he was a great talent, and I know that he could sound like anybody because I heard many of his early records where you could have sworn he was Johnny Mathis or Ray Charles. But when he decided to do a tribute to Paul McCartney, that's when he took off, and that was the sound that
was amazing.
Remember and love him for.
You know, every now and then I do these interviews, and I'm like, I just want to sit down with a stack of 45s and play them with Bobby. I think that would be so much fun just to go.
It would.
Just to play it. So let's do that sometime.
Let's do it.
So, you know, you survive through the 70s and 80s. There's Dolan's Jones, Boyce and Hart, and that's the stories in there. So let's get up to the present because we're running out of time. First of all, I want to know what's in Bobby Hart's iPod.
Bobby Hart, Nikki gave me a name, and I can't. You probably know it. It's the name of a guy who didn't want to go into when the Industrial Revolution came about, and didn't want to go up to the Times and get involved.
Oh, he call you a Luddite?
Yes, a Luddite.
Okay.
So Bobby Hart has no iPod.
All right. So if I got in your car, which by the way is the fourth thing I noticed all the way through, is you love your cars. and thanks for including the picture of, was it the Impala that went off the ditch?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the one that got smashed going over the cliff three times, turning over three times, hitting on the bottom of it.
So if I got behind your wheel and I turned the key and whatever sound system you have in there, which I'm sure is incredible, comes on, what am I likely to hear?
Well, it's a Beats sound system, only because it came with the car.
Right.
You'd likely hear very eclectic stuff depending on the day you came in. We might be playing Sirius Lee Sinatra on Sirius Radio.
Right.
We might be playing Joel Osteen channel on Sirius Radio. Which
interesting.
Is always inspirational.
Okay.
We might be playing Cousin Brucey's Sirius Radio channel. We might be playing the local PBS station here on FM. We might be playing K-Earth 101, which is the oldies station in mm-hmm. Los Angeles. And we might be sticking in a CD of somebody that we know, that somebody that we're interested in.
And there you go. With regard to the book, which is your latest project, are there new things coming that we can keep our eyes open for?
Well, the book is, you know, part of what I wanted to do with the book, I wanted to tell the stories because these are the things people have asked me about, you know, over the last 50 years. And so I think we did a pretty good job of that, and I appreciate your evaluation of it. But I also wanted to share some of the principles and some of the ideas that I came across, some that people had shared with me that made it easier for me and were shortcuts to my... looking back, you don't kind of know what, as you're going through life, you don't kind of know what's going on so much, but if you have to go through a process like this, even just putting it in chronological order, the mind plays tricks. I don't know if you realize it, but when you sit down to do that, you say, well, I'm sure that this happened before. No, it couldn't have, because this guy was already passed on. Or, you know, this, when you do the research of a book, it's quite a process.
Yeah.
And in doing so, I could see there were all of these little shortcuts that helped me on my way through that journey of success. And so I wanted to pass whatever I had learned.
Which you do. There are breaks in between. I call them the act breaks, because the first act ends with with 3 to 6 points of spiritual enlightenment, and it breaks up the book in that way. And as much as I'd love for you to explain those, they're in the book, and they're really, yes, I think, the meat that you want people to get out of the book, right?
Yeah, so that's true. And so that's kind of what the future, you asked about the future, and that's how I see my future. I think the music business has changed so much that I'm not going to be as active as I have in the past. I will do things, you know, pick and choose when they come to me. But what I'd like to do is continue sharing some of the principles, and I think that Glenn and I will probably do our second book more directly related to those kinds of things that I think people can learn from, about creativity, about changing your thoughts to change your life, and some of the things I've learned from meditation and so on.
Wow. That would be, having read the first book, I think that would be an interesting book. And in the back of my head, I'm like, I hope he does a soundtrack to that, the second book. I think that would be really interesting to hear, kind of a spiritual meditation, music coming with your soul coming through. Plus, I'm a big fan of the Hammond B3 anyway.
Ah, that's fun. Well, that's a good idea. We played around with doing a CD to go with the book, but it just wasn't time to do all of that and do it right.
Yeah.
There is, if you go on BobbyHart.com, there's an opportunity to download an unreleased Bobby Hart song, record. If you buy the book, you can buy it on Amazon or whatever, and
right,
put in that. So,
and if you don't have the Boyce and Hart anthology, you have no business listening to this show anyway.
That's right. The anthology is the one. Which one? The one that came from England?
Yeah,
yeah.
But it's available on Amazon, and you're a Luddite, so there's a lot of Boyce and Hart on iTunes as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is, because I didn't. I think the last time somebody checked for me, they said it was only I Wonder was the only thing they could find, but that's good to hear.
Yep.
And I'm sure, you know, we'll be traveling and doing some events, and there's the documentary that Rachel Lichtman made with Andrew Sandoval called Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, the guys who wrote them. That's in the works, so there'll be showings of that around, so. There's stuff going on.
There was a screening at the Silent, right? On Fairfax not that long ago.
Yeah, there was a screening last August there. There was a film festival screening in Chicago, and there were at last year's Monkey Convention at Meadowlands, New Jersey, they showed it.
So that should be coming to a streaming platform near you.
Yeah.
And, you know, Andrew does such a great job with that kind of stuff. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's good.
Parting shots, Bobby, anything you want the world to know other than what you've told them in 400 pages?
No, only that that I'm definitely grateful that people still are interested in this stuff and that people are still listening to some of the music. And you just never know. You sit down for an hour and you do what you think is creativity, and 99% of the time it's sitting there on a little tape recorder that nobody ever hears. And then, well, one of those, and you don't know which one it is, really. You don't know, all the planets align, and then one of those people still are humming and they're saying, "Oh, I love that. That was, I sang that at my graduation," or whatever. those are just the gratifying thoughts that I have, and that we got this far with a book that an agent was willing to take it on, and that a publisher was willing to take it on, and then my co-writer came on board, which made the book so much better. And so I'm grateful for every day, and for the past and for the present, and hopefully the future is going to take care of itself.
Beautiful. Bobby, thank you so much. This has been great. I'm going to stop recording right now.
Good.
And I'm going to tell you that this is, I've been looking forward to this all week, and I'm really, really glad. I hope you're as pleased with how things came out as I am.
Very good. It was a very intelligent interview and led me places that I hadn't gone in other ones that I've been doing, so this is very good. Would you do me a favor and let Creativo know, that our publicist, when this will be on, and where, so they can also promote people to tune into it?
I promised both Glenn and Carolyn, who, by the way, was awesome in connecting us.
Yeah.
That not only would I let you know, but I'd send you links. And I've got Glenn's mailing address, so because you're a Luddite, I'm going to put this on CD, and I am going to be very tickled that, for a change, Bobby Hart has a CD of mine. So,
yeah, it'd be great.
Thanks, man. This is really a pleasure. I told Glenn, and I'll tell you, count on me for an outlet if there's anything that I can't imagine what I could possibly do for you. But if you want to come back and tell some stories, that would be great. You ever want to sit down with some 45s? Nothing would be cooler for me.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Cool, man. Well,
all right, Tim, it's been fun.
The pleasure is all mine. The pleasure is all mine, man, let me tell you. Thanks. Have a great afternoon, and okay. And keep smiling. Thanks for everything.
Same to you, and talk soon. Wake up, girl. Stop and look around. Wake up, girl. Good things to be found. Wake up, girl. If you look, you will see. And you, coke for two. Things go better with Coca-Cola. Things go better with Coke. Life is much more fun when you're refreshed, and Coke refreshes you best. Wake up!
Tommy Boy said, Bobby Hart, opening up your eyes to Coke.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.